Stephen Zunis, welcome to KABU.
Great to be with you again.
Stephen Zunis studies and writes on the international system and its politics. He specializes in the Middle East, U.S. foreign policy, and strategic nonviolent action. He teaches at the University of San Francisco, coordinates its program in Middle Eastern studies. He's also active, and he writes a good deal. His best-known book is Tinderbox, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. So, Stephen Zunis, how did you feel... What did you think when watching last week's news, the U.S. embassy personnel ferried from the top of the embassy, as in Saigon? So it seems like eternity ago, as the Taliban completed their over 20-year struggle with a lightning campaign to take over Afghanistan.
First of all, I think it's important to note that it was not a military victory by the Taliban. It was basically a political collapse of the Afghan regime. Let's remember that, nominally at least, the Afghan government had over 300,000 troops at its disposal, whereas the Taliban only had 75,000 troops. The Afghan government had an air force. They had heavy equipment. They'd gotten trained by the U.S. military for nearly 20 years. They had received over $100 billion in direct U.S. military aid. I mean, there was no reason on a military basis that they wouldn't have been able to keep the Taliban at bay. But what they lacked was legitimacy in the eyes of the majority of Afghans, who saw them essentially as puppets of a foreign power. The corruption was widespread. I mean, it's they're considered one of the five most corrupt governments in the world. So, and I think Biden was correct when he asked the question about why should Americans fight and die to preserve a regime that Afghans themselves were unwilling to do so for.
My sense of it, though, I mean, that seems to me the analysis of why the regime fell. I think that one could probably add to it that after Trump made a deal to leave, and Biden, in fact, himself said he wanted to leave, the Taliban undoubtedly, and also the leaders of all the various sects and local and regional groupings of various Muslim and other sort of faiths, they must have decided, well, we better make a deal with our next set of oppressors. And I think the Taliban probably did make a deal with them. That's a, at least I've read that, a hint of that. It does seem to me the Taliban were extremely clever and the U.S. wasn't, but that's another matter. I found it, though, sort of heartbreaking watching what was happening and knowing what was going to happen to people accused of being collaborators with the United States.
Yeah, it's really horrible. And of course, the United States, indeed, I believe, has a moral responsibility to help people who may be targeted by the Taliban because of their collaboration with the United States and who might otherwise be subjected to persecution for political asylum. I mean, it's ironic that some of the very Republicans who are attacking Biden for supposedly abandoning the Afghans have also made it very, very difficult for the United States to bring in asylum seekers from Muslim countries. But in many ways, I think Biden was indeed caught in a trap by Trump. Trump, without consulting the Afghan government, made a deal with the Taliban and talks in Qatar last year, where basically the Taliban agreed not to never again harbor international terrorists like al-Qaeda and not to attack U.S. forces as long as U.S. forces withdrew by May. Now, what Biden did was he put off the deal for another few months, but he was in a situation where he had to either honor the agreement of his predecessor, or he could say, no, the deal's off, we're going to keep troops there, which basically made it so that if he kept the U.S. there, that then they would be subject to attacks, and we'd be caught in this big, long, bloody war, and Americans were getting killed. And again, he was realizing that, you know, he could keep U.S. troops there another year, another 5 years, another 20 years. It would be the same thing, and the result would be the same, that when the U.S. finally did pull out, the Taliban would take over. So in a sense, this is a giant Ponzi scheme. I mean, this is the house of cards, and I have to, and though I've been quite critical of President Biden on a number of foreign policy issues, I think he was correct in this case and being willing to call out the Ponzi scheme, even though there are some people who are now blaming him. In fact, it's ironic that the Republicans, you know, who praised Trump when he made this deal, are now attacking Biden for going through with it.
Stephen Zunis, last week I read an article in the New York Times, it was a week ago, Sunday. It was titled, "Sweep by Taliban Follows Years of Miscalculation." And it was about how all with its super modern high-tech weaponry, the U.S. was defeated by basically a fundamentalist nationalist force that was able to field a relatively disciplined, brutal, motivated guerrilla army. But the outcome, that outcome was not the result of miscalculation. Nor was Vietnam a miscalculation, nor was Iraq, nor is Honduras today, which is a death squad country destroyed recently by the U.S. because the elected leader was threatening to raise taxes and do a few other things on U.S. interests and economic interests in Honduras. Anyway, it's clear those murderous disasters were and are not the product of miscalculation, but the product of U.S. policy, that is to undermine and exterminate the leadership of the country after, in fact, it was forced to seek help from the Russians or Chinese. The irony this time was, it was particularly ironic this time, the Taliban force in its early days developed with the help of U.S. funding and support. Let's backtrack a little.
Sure. You look back, and the United States supported some of the most hardline extremist elements in the anti-Soviet resistance back in the 1980s on the grounds that these hardcore ideological Islamists would be less likely to negotiate a compromise and negotiate a peace settlement, because the goal of the United States was not really to liberate Afghanistan from the Soviets, but to basically bleed the Soviets dry, that is to get them bogged down in a long counterinsurgency war and therefore weaken them as our superpower rival. And we were willing to support the Hekmatyar faction, Hizbi Islami, these really fanatical extremists that when the Soviets are finally driven out were wrecking so much havoc across Afghanistan. I mean, there's a civil war in the 1990s, and it was the Taliban that ended up filling in that gap. Now, the Taliban was never directly supported by the U.S., but we did play a major role in their creation in the sense that the Taliban, which is basically the Pashtun word for students, grew out of these far right-wing madrasas, these religious schools that the U.S. encouraged the Saudis to set up in the refugee camps in Pakistan, where you had millions of Afghan refugees. These are virtually the only education that was available, and these kids were indoctrinated with this Salafist, Wahhabist, extremism like they practiced in Saudi Arabia. And the Afghans had always been fairly conservative and devout in their Islamic faith, but the Saudi-style stuff was a new thing. This was something that, that came fairly recently, and it was the people who went through these Islamic schools, the Saudis and the U.S. set up, formed the basis of the Taliban. And in that sense, I think, the U.S. does indeed, bear responsibility in large part, for the rise of this particularly extremist and reactionary form of Islamic governance that we're now seeing.
This is Bill Resnick, Cable Radio, the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Stephen Zunis, who teaches at the University of San Francisco, specializing in the Middle East, U.S. foreign policy, strategic nonviolent action. His best-known book is Tinderbox, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. We've been discussing the debacle of Afghanistan, the U.S. responsibility for the ruination of Afghanistan, and the heartbreaking situation of most Afghans now. So Stephen Zunis, the Afghan story is not over. The Taliban are in control. They're surely going to declare Sharia law particularly harmful to the women of Afghanistan. But there are questions about how sweeping and how many people they will deem collaborators and how they will deal with them. They're very unlikely to start killing all the troops that surrendered to them. And they owe some obligations to the various allies who broke with the Afghan government and the U.S. military when it was clear that the war was about to end. Perhaps the Taliban leadership, it might be concerned with their international legitimacy and recognition and development assistance as they govern a ruined country. Stephen, what's your sense of the Taliban? Can they be dealt with, not by the U.S., but maybe some international body attached to the United Nations? Does Afghanistan have any future?
It's hard to say. I mean, again, the good news is I don't think there will be a base for international terror like Al-Qaeda again, but I think there's real good reason to be concerned about the fate of the Afghans themselves. I mean, the initial reports coming out thus far are that there have not been mass executions. executions or some of the more draconian measures that we remember from the Taliban's rule during the 1990s up to 2001. But these guys are pretty bad news. And in any case, this is not going to be pretty. Now, the one thing that might give some glimmer of hope is that there was, despite many U.S. policies to the contrary that did not support this sort of thing, there has been some growth in Afghan civil society there. There are some projects by the United Nations, NGOs that help facilitate this. In certain ways, I think the Afghans living in urban areas, may be able to resist simply through non-cooperation some of the more draconian measures that the Taliban might otherwise be willing to impose. In other words, I think the Afghans' ability to resist might be better than it was during the Taliban's previous rule. So I don't think the Taliban has, I don't think they've had a conversion of the, in the sense that I don't think they've seen the error in their ways and they're going to be moderates now. I don't think that at all. But I think they might be, pragmatic enough to recognize, the lack of support they actually have. The lack of support for the previous government doesn't mean that people support the Taliban either. The Taliban are largely able to fill the vacuum, from the collapse of the government. And so I'm hoping, though, again, it's just a hope. I'm hopeful there'll be at least some, level in which the Taliban's rule, might not be as extreme, that they might be more pragmatic, et cetera. But again, it looks like a pretty dark future for the Afghans with the Taliban in charge, regardless.
This is Bill Resnick for our Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, talking to Stephen Zunis, who teaches and writes on the Middle East at the University of San Francisco. It's a private university in San Francisco. He's written a good deal. It's a really interesting book on strategic nonviolence. So, Stephen, the U.S. national security elite after 9/11, almost 10 years ago, focused on the Middle East. They decided it was good idea to take control of Iraq and Afghanistan and make them Western-style democracies with their free market economies. That is a model for Egypt and Lebanon, among others. And they also were going to influence Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states in human rightsy and democratic directions. And they were going to solve the Israel-Palestine conflict. Well, of course, everything now is much worse with their work. 10 years later, and having failed in just about everything, they appear ready to wash their hands of the Middle East and refocus on big power politics and that whole apparatus, military industrial complex, whole intellectual apparatus within political science departments around the United States and the neocons. They're now hyping and warning all of us to recognize that the Chinese are bent on world domination and we have to rearm to stop them. Of course, they ignore that the great threat we actually face is global warming that all of us on the planet face. Anyway, they found a new enemy that we must spend a fortune on for consultants and think tanks and, of course, the military and military goods to defend our country. Stephen, maybe I'm exaggerating or being too colorful, but I believe that's correct in terms of the coming direction of U.S. foreign military policy.
Well, first of all, I never thought that democracy was part of the equation. I mean, that was sort of the excuse. I mean, the United States is under both Republican and Democratic administrations has propped up some of those brutal dictatorships in the world. Right now, Biden is siding with the Republicans and fighting with Democrats in Congress who want to put some human rights provisions into the massive amounts of taxpayer-funded military aid we give to prop up the Sisi dictatorship in Egypt, one of the most brutal regimes in the world in terms of the number of political prisoners, extrajudicial killings, torture, and the like. We support the Biden and continue the Republican support of the Israeli occupation, as well as Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara, including their illegal annexation of that African nation. Arms are still flowing to the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, and other family dictatorships in the Gulf. So the line about that they were trying to bring democracy to Afghanistan and Iraq was disingenuous from the beginning. If we really wanted democracy, we would push democracy in countries we actually had some influence over, not ones that we were trying to invade. But in terms of your broader question, most strategic analysts, recognize that, the most important region in the world in the coming years will be Asia, with the rise of China and the rapid economic development in that part of the world. And ever since Obama, there's been an effort to shift our strategic attention there. But unfortunately for U.S. policy planners, the messes that we created in the Middle East, particularly during the Bush era, but some of the longer-term problems, such as the unconditional U.S. support for Israel, which has made it impossible for any kind of peace settlement to emerge there. We have these ongoing conflicts that have ended up sapping the attention of our strategic planners and others who would like to move on. Now, with the fact that the rise of access to natural gas, and more importantly, the very exciting developments that we have made in terms of renewable energy and conservation mean that the oil that's always been a center of U.S. Middle East policy is less and less of an issue. And that, again, can also make it so that the U.S. could put its attention elsewhere. But as you imply in your question, what kind of attention? Is it going to be the same kind of mistakes? Is it going to be the same kind of emphasis on militarism? Is it trying to exaggerate a foreign threat? Is it going to be an effort to manufacture crises that's going to create future confrontations down the line? And we're not talking about just individual terrorist groups or a few despots of middle powers. We're talking about a potential rival superpower in the form of China. But I think that the underlying issue is that we really need to recognize that there are limits to what military power can do, that the United States does not have the means of creating a world in our image, being able to make things go the way that we want to. We're going to have to think about limits of power. We're going to have to think about compromise. We're going to have to think about non-military solutions. And we need to recognize that we really can't afford to be the world's policeman anymore, that this pressing needs at home. I mean, the United States is falling behind in so many areas that I travel, prior to COVID, I traveled abroad a fair amount, and it was just amazing to go to all these countries in Asia and Europe and whatever and see broadband internet everywhere, to see high-speed rail, to see, basic infrastructure, healthcare, other needs taken care of, things that we can't do. The United States is becoming a more backward country. Why? Because we keep getting and spending the majority of our discretionary federal budget on the military every year instead of needs at home. And I think what happened in Afghanistan is it will hopefully be a reminder of people that, yeah, you can have all the guns you want, you can be really, really powerful and spend all this on the military, but you can't even stop a ragtag band of religious fanatics in rural Afghanistan from taking down the government we spent trillions of dollars to prop up over the years. I mean, we need to really reevaluate our understanding of security and national interests.
Stephen Zunis, thanks a lot for talking to us. Where do we find your book on nonviolence and some of your other writing on international issues?
You can check my website, stephenzunis.org. That's StephenZunes.org. My most recent article, which is not yet up on my website, you can find in Truth Out, where I talk about the history of the U.S. role in Afghanistan. That's truthout.org. And on my website, you will find links to my books, both the nonviolence book and Tinderbox, but also I'll soon be releasing the second edition of my book on Western Sahara, the little-known conflict where the U.S. has facilitated Morocco's invasion occupation of the nation of Western Sahara, and how the U.S. is basically, once again, running roughshod over very fundamental principles of international law and the United Nations Charter and others in order to support the aggressive designs of a right-wing ally.
Stephen Zunis, keep up the good work. Thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.